morning, everyone. I want to welcome you here to the United States Institute of Peace. Congratulate you on being tremendously brave coming out in the middle of a snowstorm, which none of us expected, most particularly me. And I'd like to begin this morning by introducing the president of USIP, Ambassador Richard Sullivan.
Welcome to you all, and again, we appreciate your coming out for a very important event despite the unexpected and brief snowstorm. I understand it's supposed to be up in the 50s tomorrow. This meeting marks the launch of a new venture for the Institute of Peace, a working group that will focus on Haiti. And the working group, which will meet over the coming year, is modeled on the Institute's highly successful working groups that have focused on Iraq and Afghanistan. This effort will be chaired by former Senator Malcolm Wallop, who's had a longstanding interest in the situation in Haiti. Most unfortunately, Mal is unable to be with us this morning, but I know he'll be in attendance at future sessions. The executive director of our working group is Bob Perito, who, as we all know, is looking for the Lone Ranger to come in and solve a lot of problems around the world. And Bob will be chairing this morning's session. Our goal for the Haiti Working Group is to provide a forum for discussion of the considerable challenges that face Haiti today and Haiti's relationship with the United States. What is our point of departure, just in terms of the extensive history that we could establish as a baseline for these discussions? Today, of course, is almost 2 years after Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide left Haiti under exceptional circumstances, and as we all know from the press, today there's a new president, René Préval, although I noticed in the morning papers that Aristide is now in negotiations perhaps to return to Haiti, an interesting development that we'll no doubt discuss during the morning. And like Aristide's departure from the presidency, Préval's election also was under rather exceptional circumstances, also pretty well reported in our press. Faced with civil disorder and allegations of election fraud, the Haitian Election Commission voted to disqualify over 80,000 blank ballots, and this increased Préval's percentage of the vote to 51%, as required by the election law, enabled him to become president on that basis. Was this Haitian ingenuity or a bending of the election law? Whichever it was apparently a Haitian solution to a Haitian problem. I think many of you know that who follow the issues in this country, that since the days of gunboat diplomacy at the turn of the last century, Haiti has repeatedly defied efforts by the United States and the international community to impose solutions from the outside to its problems. No matter how well-meaning, how cleverly executed, or how generously funded, external efforts have not succeeded in solving Haiti's chronic political instability and helping to break its grinding poverty. Now, this is an issue of considerable importance to the United States, but one that has received only limited public attention and discussion. Haiti is close to the United States, of course, geographically, but it's only on the periphery of our political vision. But issues of narcotics trafficking, illegal immigration, the HIV/AIDS situation make the situation in Haiti important for many aspects of U.S. foreign policy and our national security interests. Given Haiti's violent history and geographical proximity, we could ignore future opportunities to support progress in this country, hopefully through its new leadership, only at our peril. So what is the issue of Haiti's future? That's the question that we're trying to explore here through a group of veteran observers who have considerable experience with Haiti and its neighbors. And let me very briefly introduce my former colleague and friend, John Maestoe. Haven't seen John in some while. Nice to see you. He's ambassador U.S. Ambassador to the Organization of American States. Ambassador Roger Noriega
is visiting. Not here yet.
Oh, he isn't here yet, but he will be here. Visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and former Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs. Mark Schneider, Senior Vice President of the International Crisis Group, and Joanna Mendelson Foreman, Director of Peace, Security, and Human Rights Issues at the United Nations Foundation. And then we have a surprise guest who hasn't arrived yet, but we're
pretty... He's here.
Oh, all right. Yes, he's here.
He's really a surprise.
I'm surprised. Jacques Bernard, Chairman of the Haiti Election Commission, the official who supervised the recent elections. We also, of course, want to engage you who come here today in these discussions, so we've scheduled time for questions and back and forth after the on-the-record presentation by our panel. And I just might add that we'll be holding meetings similar format in the future as we follow up on this opening session. So again, let me welcome you all and turn the podium over to Bob Perito, who will say a little word of welcome about our first speaker, Jacques Bernard. Thank you again for coming.
Thank you, Dick. The impetus for this working group starts in large part out of a project which USIP ran about a year ago. USIP was tasked by Congress to facilitate a study of the United Nations, and one of the working groups that looked at United Nations operations around the world was one led by Malcolm Wallop and General Wesley Clark that went to Haiti. And Gary Matthews, who's with the Institute this morning, is here with us this morning, was part of that group. They were so struck by what they found there that when they came back, they said, that the Institute really needed to engage, and that's why we're here this morning. We're live on C-SPAN this morning, so if you come up to ask a question, slick your hair. So we're very grateful that C-SPAN's with us this morning as well. I'd like to begin by introducing our first speaker of the day. We're going to speak in this order. Jacques Bernard will speak first. Ambassador Maestos will speak second. Mark Schneider will speak third. Roger Noriega, who I'm sure will be here by that time, will speak fourth. And Joanna Mendelson, Dr. Joanna Mendelson, will that cleanup. This morning I'd like to begin by introducing Jacques Bernard, who we are very grateful to have with us this morning. Many of you probably read the report in the New York Times yesterday saying that Mr. Bernard had been forced to leave Haiti under threats against his life and after his farmhouse was burned. So we're very glad that he's with us this morning, that he's safe and sound, and I'd like to begin with by introducing Jacques Bernard, who supervised the election in Haiti.
Thank you very much, and good morning to all of you for being here. And it's really a small world because a lot of people in this room I recognize, and I didn't realize that before I came here. Let me just start it by saying that on February 7th, we have what I believe were the best elections in Haiti for many, many years. And most people in Haiti and around the world thought indeed that we had good election, we had fair election, and there were no challenges for as far as the elections are concerned. And then suddenly, 2-3 days later, everything unravels, and we saw demonstration in the streets, and people are saying that there were massive fraud in the election. So then the question is, what happened between February 7 and maybe February 13, when the crowd had invaded the Montana Hotel searching for me? It's amazing in Haiti how you could be a hero one day and then 2-3 days later you become the villain. So it's an interesting phenomenon, and it's worth looking at it to realize exactly what happened. But in order to understand what happened, I think I have to go back a little bit to when I came to the CEP. When I came to the CEP about three and a half months ago, the CEP has been in existence for about 18 months. And I can tell you that after 18 months, they were no further to having election than on day one. And the only thing is that the OAS really did a fantastic job in registering people and printing the identity card that will always be used, that will also be used as a voter's card. Now, when I came in, I reorganized the CEP because what happened is that we had three independent teams. We had the CEP team, we had the OAS team, and we had the minister team. And there was very little communication between the three teams working for election. And that is the reason why we haven't made any advances at all in the process. So my first task was to bring together the three themes and to create one theme. But when I came to the CEP, I had two basic conditions. One is that all the operational structure would be brought down to the level of the Director General, and also the fact that I asked for a salary equivalent to about 2.5 cents a month. So the two conditions were accepted, and I started at the CEP. Now, that created some problem because there were members at the board level who were used to running their little section of the CEP, and they did not want to yield power. They wanted to retain the kind of power they have on some of the operational structure of the CEP. And, of course, that created some conflict between myself and some of the members. But we struggled all along, and we advanced in the process. And we were able to deliver election on February 7th. But what happened in between is that there were always a lot of people that did not want election in Haiti. You had a number of people operating in the margin, and I think we made reference to them, to some of the people that are involved in illegal activities. And you also have some of the smaller political parties, the people who have obtained maybe 0.1% of the votes of the ballots, that did not want election because they would disappear from the political scene. So we had a whole sector or section of the political class in Haiti who did not want election. And particularly at the board level, we had two members who were totally opposed to election, and they have done everything they could to oppose election. And I won the political class in Haiti. I won the international community. And I also warned the executive that the campaign of disinformation being carried out by these two guys would lead the day of the election, of the day of the proclamation of the results, that they were going to cry foul and say that the election was full of fraud and that we tried to steal the vote of the people. And it is indeed what happened. And the people reacted. But I have to tell you a curious fact, and something that I want people to understand right here, is that when people started to demonstrate in the street, Préval was not even in Port-au-Prince. Préval was in Marmelade. And when the government and minister felt that they were losing control of the situation in Port-au-Prince, they called on Préval and asked him to come to Port-au-Prince. So they sent an helicopter to get him there, and they brought him to the palace. And there were only six people who spoke there. It was the President of the Republic of Haiti, the Prime Minister, Ambassador Valdez, the President of the CEP, Mathurin, myself, and Préval himself. And we have decided to create an informal commission to investigate to see if they were frauds, and to come to a conclusion as to the result of the vote, because when we started to count the vote, Préval was at 65%, and that is to be expected, because the very location of the tabulation center was around the slums of Haiti, where he has a lot of popularity. So these were the first reports that we were receiving, and gradually, as we received reports from other parts of the country, the percentage started to go down and to dip slightly below 50%. But I have to tell you that the next guy, Maniga, was only at around 11%. So Preval is a clear winner in this election. And there were two ways he could have handled the issue. He could either decide to follow the law and go into a second round, or he could challenge it. And I think the Constitution of Haiti gave him a basis to challenge the way the blank votes were treated when the results were announced. But he chose instead to follow another route. And I must tell you that he's not the one who put the people in the streets. When he came over and he spoke, he said very clearly and very candidly that he didn't think that he could really tell the people to not to march. And so I think it was a moment of truth. And I can tell you that when the people went to the street and started demonstrating, it wasn't as a result of Preval calling for it, but it was rather a result of two of the advisors at the CEP level, at the board level, that started calling the election fraudulent, when in fact, for 3 days, there were no people complain about the election. In fact, these were the most modern election we had in Haiti, because we introduced two elements of modernity. One is the identity card, where that shows the picture of the person and also the fingerprint of the party. The second is the concept of voting centers. Instead of spreading about 12,000 to 13,000 polling stations throughout the country, we gathered them into polling centers, and we had about 804, and that really allowed us to control the process. And the third element is, of course, the tabulation center, because traditionally in Haiti, we had good election to the extent that people would go and vote. And the cheating really started after the election, when they started combining the results. And that is the reason why we created the tabulation center, where the result would come to Port-au-Prince, and in front of the observers and political parties representative, we can compile the results. So this election went pretty well. There were some problems at first, because the poll workers did come to work late. Instead of being there at 5 o'clock in the morning, they started arriving at 6 or 7 o'clock. And there were a lot of people in line that were pretty impatient. But as the day went along, things fell in order, and the election went pretty well. So what happened in between during those 2 days, it's clear manipulation on the part of two advisors, and Preval as a politician took advantage of the situation and basically rode the wave, and we know what happened after that. The board members were called into session by the executive. I did not participate in that meeting. I refused to participate in that meeting. So I wasn't there, so I don't know the detail of what happened. But I can tell you that at the end of the day, or at the end of the night, around 3 o'clock in the morning, it was decided that not to count the blank votes. I have with me the electoral decree and also the constitution. And in the opinion of a lot of lawyers and constitutional lawyers in Haiti, Preval has a basis to challenge the electoral law, but he refused to do that. He refused to go another route. So all in all, these were good elections. And in my opinion, Preval is the winner of this election. He could have gone into a second round, but he chose not to, or he could have challenged the law. He chose not to, which is unfortunate, because I don't think it's a good thing for democracy in Haiti. And as far as I'm concerned, because they had to find a scapegoat for the fact that his percentage dropped below 50%, then of course I was the one chosen. Mm-hmm. So I pay a dear price for trying to help my country and to organize good election, good honest election in Haiti. And finally, I felt that my life was so threatened that I have decided to leave Haiti and to come here and to see what happened. Already I heard that they have announced that the second round for parliamentary election would be April 38, which is a little bit puzzling because I know for every month the international community spend about $3 to $4 million for the election in Haiti. So the longer the delay the process, the more money the international community will have to inject into the process. Why is it that they have delayed for so long? I don't know, because in my opinion, even though we lost a few days or maybe a week time, I think we could easily have a second one of election at least toward the end of the month of March. I think that leaves us enough time for legal challenges from the candidate and also enough time for the printing of the ballot for the second round for the parliamentary candidate. So this is where we are at right now in Haiti. What's going to happen, I don't know, but I think the prevails selection of choosing to reach power the way it did, it's not a good beginning. And I think there are a lot of people that are disappointed, even though everybody recognizes that he is a winner, and if he is indeed a winner. And if I were to be accused of fraud, I always say to myself, maybe I did it for Préval because he was at 49% and the next guy was only at 11%. So I really quite don't understand, did not understand what happened. And frankly, he didn't want to go into a second round, and it's really truly unfortunate that it turned out that way. I will stop right there, and if there are any questions a little bit later, I'll be glad to answer them. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Ambassador Solomon, for the invitation to come here today. I'm going to speak from two points of view, both from the point of view of the Organization of American States, and I am the U.S. permanent representative to the Organization of American States, as well as to address United States policy toward Haiti, and in particular with regard to these elections. Happily, in the audience today, we have the presence of the Director of the Office of Caribbean Affairs, Brian Nichols, who will be able to address any issue that I am not able to address. Because as those of us in the foreign affairs business know about the State Department, it's the office directors who really know the issues and do all the work. First of all, for the record, what you have just heard from the president of the Electoral Council of Haiti rings very true to what the U.S. diplomatic mission and the OAS saw in Haiti. In a word, on February 7th, the Haitian people crossed a major milestone when, through a peaceful and successful electoral process, they elected a new president. It always does well for U.S. diplomats to quote the Secretary of State. And she said, following the election, and I quote, "I congratulate the Haitian people for demonstrating their commitment to democracy by voting in large numbers on February 7th. Haitians can take great pride in the success of these elections. I also applaud the interim government of Haiti, the Provisional Electoral Council, CEP, United Nations, MINUSTA, and the Organization of American States for organizing this successful election and assisting the people of Haiti to freely elect their leaders. It is important that Haiti's citizens and political parties respect the final results and support the democratic process as Haiti moves from an interim government to an elected one. We will continue to support the people of Haiti as they progress toward a transparent and stable democracy. Since one of the subjects of this event today is U.S. policy toward Haiti, it is very important to cite what that policy is, and I will address that here. Of course, Haitians continue to face daunting challenges to establishing a stable democracy. The United States has and will continue to work with the people of Haiti to support them as their democracy and society face the most difficult of times and obstacles, and there are huge, huge challenges ahead. I would like to point out, because in Washington there are always questions about what U.S. policy really is, to note that the United States government has allocated over $400 million in bilateral assistance to Haiti since 2004. And an important tranche of this had to do with supporting the OAS and MINUSTA to support the administration and security of the February 7th elections. The United States government approach to Haiti has been to combine an unprecedented level of bilateral assistance to dovetail with multilateral efforts to provide broad-based, robust, and effective assistance as Haiti restores its democracy and eventually its livelihood. With regard to the Organization of American States, this is something that we call relevant multilateralism in Haiti, and it is an indication of what we're about in the hemisphere as well. In Haiti, the U.S. has worked with the OAS and a host of like-minded countries that comprise MINUSTA and others as well, which have provided a strong partnership with the clear support of the entire hemisphere for the restoration of democracy in Haiti, and in a remarkable show of solidarity, our neighbors in this hemisphere have provided funds and troops and political support that have brought our common hopes and goals this far. And I can tick off here the various things that have been provided to Haiti, but the president of the CEP put his finger on the most important one from the OAS point of view. The OAS special mission to strengthen democracy in Haiti worked, of course, closely with the UN and the CEP to prepare for the elections, the February 7th elections. Now, the national identity card preparation and distribution was really, really a major effort. Those who understand Haiti better than I do point consistently to the fact that Haitian citizens have a card with their photograph and their basic information, which in Haiti is an indication of Haitian citizenship. And the importance of having this identification card to be recognized in Haiti. We know the numbers. The registration process, which the OAS carried out, registered 3.7 million. Somebody may want to correct me on the statistics.
3.5.
I'm sorry,
3.5.
How do you like that, Mark? Okay, 3.5 million. I'm going to talk to the people who prepared this brief. More than 90% were distributed, more than 95%, I understand. The voting centers issue, as the president of the CEP just indicated, was very, very important, and of course the OAS role in the voting centers and the distribution, the successful distribution of voting cards speaks for itself. What's ahead? There is much that's ahead. As a matter of fact, there was a meeting of the Permanent Council yesterday with the Secretary General to look at the challenges ahead, the rest of the elections, and then what happens afterwards. Because it's not enough in Haiti to say, well, They had their elections. We did our thing. Now we can all rest. Not so. The United States is prepared to be engaged in Haiti over many years. And MINUSTAH just recently has announced, or the United Nations has just approved the extension of MINUSTAH for 6 months. We'll see what happens as we approach the end of that six-month period. But the engagement of the hemispheric community, the engagement of the United Nations, the engagement of countries like France, and of course the engagement of the United States are absolutely key with regard to the success of democracy in Haiti. What is the United States doing? Let me just tick off some of the things we have done over the past almost two-year period, and which will give an indication of the directions in which we're going. Our bilateral assistance goes to economic infrastructure, which means providing short and longer-term job creation and economic growth opportunities through the building up of rural infrastructure and agriculture. There are short-term urban job programs, increased microfinance and microcredit lending, support for essential services like electricity and sanitation, and stimulating Haiti's unique artistic and crafts sector. On the ministerial assistance side, we are talking about aiding government ministries and agencies by making available technical assistance to the Ministry of Finance to assist with creating an anti-corruption unit, the rehabilitation of the Ministry of Justice and the port facilities in Port-au-Prince, training of staff and providing commodities and office equipment for several ministries and agencies, and of course, the third big aspect is education, but there's another one as well, it's health. On the education side, expanding programs to support rehabilitating schools, to provide back-to-school assistance to students and assist Haitian school the Haitian school system in preparations for the next school year. And there's the healthcare side that perhaps a lot of people do not know that the United States provides preventative and primary health care services to well over one-third of the Haitian population. And over we provide vaccinations to practically every child in Haiti. And this is done through a network of 29 non-governmental organizations with an outreach of 2.6 million people. Then, of course, there's the effort to combat AIDS. Haiti is a major recipient of our AIDS aid. So what I've just described to you is United States participation with the international community to achieve something that we call relevant multilateralism. That piece also includes working with the United Nations through MINUSTAH. MINUSTAH, of course, is comprised of about 10,000 personnel, military and civilian, representing 45 countries from all around the globe. And we are providing support to MINUSTAH stabilization efforts in a variety of ways. We have the UNPOL, the civilian the police organization includes about 50 United States citizens. Mm. And of course, our support for the Haitian National Police includes vetting and training to improve respect for human rights. The World Bank is focused on Haiti. There was a meeting just day before yesterday. Of course, there was the previous donor effort with which the United States was involved to pledge more than $1 billion to Haiti. Now what? Let me go back to the Secretary of State, who has also shown the way ahead in a policy way. Just a few days ago, before the Congress of the United States, the Secretary said, and I quote, "We're going to work with the Preval government. We want this government to succeed. We're going to work to see what other resources we may need to," and it's happened to me. The last part of the quote, Brian, I don't have, but I will provide it. It is a commitment. It is a commitment. It is a commitment of the United States over the short and medium term to remain involved in Haiti. Thank you.
Thanks very much, John. For those of you that are fans of the National Football League, you know that when you go to a game, periodically throughout the game, the action will just stop on the field and the players will mix and mingle and wander around. And that's because that's something called a television timeout. And I'm told we need a 30-second or 60-second television timeout for C-SPAN. So for the next 60 seconds, you're at ease. Then we'll begin again.
60 seconds? 60 seconds, really?
Yeah,
relevant. It's my turn.
Okay, because I want to use it.
I didn't mean for everybody to leave.
Yeah, I mean, we're not involved in multilateralism, you know, just because to make us feel good. We want it to be relevant.
So I appreciate
it. I mean, there is multilateralism that really isn't worth it.
My gosh, yes, you're here. Well, good to see you.
How are you? Good to see you.
Dick, what a pleasure seeing you. Hey, this is 20 years from what happened in our favorite country.
That's right.
Good to see you. That's the
way I hear. Well, I can't do this forever, Dick.
Yes, you can. We're all trying to stay on as long as we can.
Yeah, yeah, indeed.
Good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you, dear.
Hello, Bill.
What? The dorm meeting take place.
About a year ago. Yeah.
Well, now it's supposed to be.
Hope so.
Yeah, I charge for this.
Okay. I don't know. I think you're right. There is another donor meeting coming up soon.
Yeah,
I think so. There was one at the bank 2 days ago. That's right. Oh yeah, this is.
I'll get you the update. I've been working with
Okay, I think we're good to go. Could I ask everybody to take their seats again?
Yeah.
And I'd like to introduce Mark Schneider.
At the World Bank. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Let me just start by saying how pleased I am to be here, and even more that the Institute of Peace is focusing on Haiti. This is the only failed state in the Western Hemisphere. It is now undergoing a political transition that most resembles a high wire act in deep trouble. The pole is unbalanced, the cable is frayed, and the winds are gale force. And while I want to thank Senator Malcolm Wallop for chairing this working group, and Bob for being the executive director, Ambassador Solomon for being here earlier, I think it is absolutely essential that everyone recognize that there's a continuing need to focus on Haiti's plight, and on the fact that there is a slim opportunity that still exists to help aid Haiti cross that abyss. And let me also say at the outset that I think we all should recognize the heroic efforts by Jacques Bernard to, in fact, rescue the election in Haiti. Since October, he has done yeoman work in bringing about the elections. Without those efforts, there simply would not have been any first round on February 7th. And although it's probably the last thing that he wants to hear, I truly hope that he does decide to return to Haiti to help organize and carry out the second round of the parliamentary elections. And I would hope that MINUSTAH would provide whatever security is necessary, and that the Haitian provisional government and the United States and others and the UN would provide the political support that he needs as well. Now, I think we also need to step a little bit back and remember Haiti is going through the second post-conflict decade. And I think that it's only fair to say the critical mistakes were made a decade ago. Perhaps the most significant in terms of lessons to be learned was the decision to pull out the U.S. peacekeeping forces 2 years after the return of President Aristide, before the institutions of a fragile democracy really even came close to becoming self-sustaining. The second, I think, was the failure to recognize that what began as a very successful, in my view anyway, effort between 1995 and 1997 to establish a professional, non-politicized civilian police force essentially came to an end when the then commissioner of police was forced out of the country by death threats because he was opposing efforts to politicize that police force. Essentially, that spelled the death knell for an independent, nonpartisan police force in Haiti. The third was that elections frequently were forced at times without the level of preparation, both technical and political, that would permit them to serve as a credible mechanism for the transfer of power. And I think some of those lessons really were not learned in the process in Haiti during this time cycle as well. And finally, spoilers were not identified and strategies not developed to co-opt or to root them out. The International Crisis Group has now been in Haiti since almost August 2004. We've produced 5 reports, and we've attempted to focus on what can be done based on the lessons of the past to ensure that this transition would be more successful. Haiti is the hemisphere's poorest country. It has been ruled by a predatory state for more than a century, largely controlled by and for a small economic and political elite that has largely consigned the majority of Haiti citizens to a second-class status in which there is virtually no education, health care, or economic opportunity. We're now 2 years after the departure of former President Aristide and 2 weeks after the first round of the presidential and parliamentary elections. Those elections, I think, during this process have been defined too often as the end of the transition rather than the beginning. After 4 postponements, the elections took place amid doubts about the adequacy of logistics, the late designation of some of those voting centers, the number of them, the size of others, and therefore the time available to train poll workers and the degree of civic education for the populace. And I think that some of the problems early on and during the election were a result of those problems not being fully resolved. Nevertheless, Jacques is correct. I think those were the best elections in terms of Haitian participation on election day that Haiti's held. In fact, when I was there, one of the MINUSTA workers who trained some of the poll workers said that in 8 international elections in which she had participated in the Balkans and elsewhere, this was the most difficult. Nevertheless, I think that the bottom line is that in Haiti, most people recognize that on election day, it came off better than most of the others in the past 15 years. But elections have 4 phases. There's the campaign, the voting, the counting, and then acceptance of the results. The voting, as I say, went relatively well. The other phases had substantial problems. The campaign really did far less than what it should in this kind of environment to raise the issues, to provide opportunities for alternative options to be presented, and to provide to some degree an understanding of the populace of the different platforms of the different candidates. On election day, the enormous determination of the Haitian people overcame whatever those remaining logistical obstacles. Turnout, I think, may have even been higher than the 63% that's officially used. And I think the reason for that high turnout is fundamentally that the Haitian people are desperate for change and desperate for a better future. And that desperation was reflected in their willingness to walk many kilometers, and as one young man told me at 12:45 after having deposited his ballot in a huge warehouse with no light, where the construction materials were still in the center of the warehouse, that he'd waited 7 hours in order to cast that vote. That's a determination that not many of us would demonstrate. Obviously, the actual counting in voting centers, most of which did not have electricity, with difficulties in reading the ballots of many voters, was viewed by most observers as fair. The difficulty was in getting all of the tally sheets from the voting centers to the tabulation center in a way that they could be entered. And there were substantial problems. And I think it's important to recognize that some tally sheets were lost purposefully, some were mishandled. There was some manipulation, apparently, of some of the unused ballots being put into the boxes where the used ballots and voted ballots were displayed. Some of that was innocent. Some of it was far from innocent. The average number of blanks at each polling station was around 10. But some other voting centers showed 100 blanks. It just didn't make sense. You've heard the final result. It was an 8-1 decision of the Provisional Electoral Council. That always will be controversial. But so, too, was Florida and the hanging chads. But there was a clear, pragmatic, and, as you've also heard, a legal rationale relating to the Constitution of Haiti and the provision that requires that whoever wins have a clear majority of the votes cast. And therefore, the decision was made to use what's called the Belgian formula, which was to distribute the blank votes among the different candidates, which pushed René Préval back over the 50% mark and resulted in his being declared president, a declaration which is accepted, I believe, internationally and to a large extent throughout Haiti as well. There obviously are those who wanted to see a second round. Several of the candidates have objected. At least one filed an appeal. Nevertheless, I think the result has been that the result of the election, where René Préval won essentially four times more votes than his second challenger, the second candidate, and more votes than any of 32 other candidates, that the choice of the people was quite clear. He will be sworn in sometime in either late March or late April, whenever there's a Congress available to receive him. That parliamentary second round, as you've heard, is likely to be delayed. How long is not clear. Nevertheless, there is an issue that goes beyond the elections, and I'm going to try and focus a bit more on those issues. The warring sides of Haiti's political divide remain almost as polarized today as they were before President Aristide's departure. The international community has not been able to forge a consensus or sufficient consensus on either a common agenda between those forces, which crudely might be viewed as now L'Espoir, La Valasse, and the Haitian poor on one side, and the traditional center-right and left opposition political and business elite on the other. With Préval's declaration as president-elect, there have been a series of meetings between President Préval and his advisors and some of those opposition, which hopefully the international community will use its good offices to sponsor further indications that there's a possibility for some minimum consensus between those two parties, between now and when President Préval takes office. Ultimately, the President and Parliament have to work together if Haiti is to move forward. There are several pieces of good news, but before I get to them, I do want to raise at least some question about Ambassador Maestos' fulsome description of the level of commitment of the United States. I have some serious questions that has been sufficient. There's no question that the U.S. has made probably the single largest financial contribution. I think the U.S. has been engaged politically and diplomatically. But let me just give you a couple of the other aspects that one has to take into consideration. There are 7,200 military troops in Haiti under the United Nations banner, under MINUSTAH. As of yesterday, the UN website lists that the United States has contributed 4 officers. The United Nations Police Force has some 1,897 authorized international police. The United States has 50 police among them. And we have, I should add, a lot of Haitian American police in different cities who would make extremely good members of that international police force. China, by the way, has three times the number of the United States at this point. It just simply it seems to us that the United States should make a larger contribution with respect to the peacekeeping forces, both military and police, and particularly because in Haiti, they actually are viewed quite positively in terms of their ability to provide order. Now, the good news, as you know, is that Brazil and the Latin American countries have taken the lead on the military and Canada on the police. The bad news is that more forces are required today, and particularly to help a new government during the time period when it is trying to establish a new non-politicized police force, judiciary, the institutions of the rule of law. And there's a need for a more competent rapid reaction force and a more effective one, frankly, than the Jordanians have been able to provide. And I would say that the major need in this area is for MINUSTAH to increase the number of civilian police during this time period. But they shouldn't do it by reducing the military and switching it to police. Keep the military level where it is and increase the police level. Now, and why is that? Why is there a need? Over the course of the past year, the level of violence in Haiti has simply been unacceptable. The kidnapping rate in December was 240. Even in January, despite a major reduction, it averaged 60. During the past 6 months, Haiti has rivaled Colombia in terms of the highest level of kidnapping in the world. And that insecurity, by the way, has an impact on the degree to which donors are able to get projects moving, and particularly donors are able to get projects moving in the areas where they're most needed, in those urban slums of Cité Soleil and Bel Air and Carrefour, just as an example. Now, what is before us? The election cycle has to be completed. We focus on the presidential election, but there's a parliamentary election out there. The first round will not be concluded until, I suspect, today or tomorrow. Senatorial races for the 30 senators will be finally, the results will be counted or will be reported in Haiti today, I'm told, and tomorrow the results of the first round for deputies, 99 deputies. And then there will be a second round, and that second round is now being planned. And with respect to that second round, I would hope that people would stop and say, what more is needed to provide a permanent MINUSTAH military and police presence at the 83 voting centers where they were not present during the first round? And I also believe they should ask the question, what additional logistical support would be useful in those voting centers where they decided that they had to use mules in order to carry the ballots after the election? I understood at some point that MINUSTAH had requested an additional 10 helicopters, and somebody should provide them. I've always argued, and we've always argued, that the closest and most competent force is the United States SOUTHCOM. But in any case, somebody should provide them, and or MINUSTAH should rent them from the private sector. But whatever is needed needs to be provided. There were also 9 voting centers that were trashed or burned, and voters could not vote. Additional resources are needed to ensure that that doesn't happen a second time. Now, beyond the elections, yesterday you heard there was a donors meeting. It reported that of the $1.2 billion pledged at the framework a conference in July 2004, $780 million have been disbursed. I would just simply say that a substantial part of that also related to peacekeeping costs. Much more is needed to improve and affect the lives of Haitian citizens. Today, 70% of the Haitian population earns less than a dollar a day. 40% of the Haitian children who should be in school are not in school. 5% of the adult Haitian population suffer from HIV/AIDS. Haiti has the highest rate of maternal mortality in the Western Hemisphere, something on the order of 300 to 400 times what it is in many other places in the region. A lot more needs to be done. Now, there is a second piece of good news, which is that today in New York, I understand that a status of forces agreement will be signed between the Haitian Prime Minister and the United Nations. And that essentially is implementing the resolution adopted a week ago that extends for 6 months the peacekeeping mission in Haiti. And I'm hopeful that that language makes it clear that they have the authority to protect civilians and to take the initiative on disarmament. There's a third piece of good news. You all should take a look at the bipartisan Senate Foreign Relations Committee staff report following the elections. That report, I think, reflects again an important difference between the past and the present. There is a bipartisan agreement that Haiti needs to be supported and the new government needs to be supported. And I think that this staff report reflects that. But let's be clear. The international commitment for state building or peace building in Haiti doesn't end 6 months from now or 2 years from now. It has to continue for at least a decade, if not a generation. And that peacekeeping mission, including a military and police presence, I suspect will have to be there for at least 5 years. In terms of the tasks, the new government's first task is to design and implement an effective disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration process for illegal armed groups, whether they're in the urban centers or whether they're the ex-FOD, the ex-military forces of Haiti, in rural centers. That DDR program was called for in the first United Nations resolution. It was not implemented, either by the government or by the United Nations forces and the international community. That needs to be done. And its second first task is to build its own non-politicized police force, carry out reform of the judiciary, and the prison system. These elements of the rule of law are essential first steps to constructing a democracy in Haiti. And down the road, I think constitutional reform is another challenge as well. Haiti needs international help in every aspect of political, economic, and social state building. If insecurity requires a first response, so too does corruption. Haiti's government will not be able to tackle the challenge of corruption facing that nation alone. It needs to end the widespread corruption at the ports that divert customs and port fees away from the state treasury and into private pockets. And that's a fundamental source of income for the Haitian government. Hopefully the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, the OAS, bilateral donors will offer to the Preval government a partnership to supervise the financial side of the ports. The other end of the financial cycle to get a hold of corruption is to provide international assurance that state funds are being spent through a transparent budget approved by the parliament. If the Preval government asks for that assistance, which, by the way, is now being done by the World Bank in Liberia at that government's request, it would give great confidence to donors and to the private sector and to civil society that a new era had dawned in Haiti. And that engagement with private sector, civil society, the parliament, and donors is essential to deal with every part of Haiti's social and economic infrastructure. Its public school capacity needs to be built so that those 40% of the school population that should be in school have schools to go to and teachers to teach them. They need support to deal with the problem of HIV/AIDS and infant maternal mortality. There's also a need for major physical infrastructure in water and sewer, electricity, roads. And finally, actually two finallys. First, Haiti needs to be helped to end the consumption of its basic remaining trees for charcoal for home heating fuel. There needs to be a subsidized plan for moving Haiti away from using charcoal to using, as in most of the region, propane or other sources. And finally, the international community, and here I would say MINUSTAH and the OAS, has to help the new Haitian government identify who are the spoilers, the drug traffickers, kidnappers, the gangs, and help them develop strategies to co-opt or defeat them. Elections, a quick exit by peacekeepers, and a sharp drop in international assistance will put Haiti in the same status as Afghanistan or Somalia a decade ago, a permanent failed state vulnerable to takeover not only by criminal gangs, but worse. And that cannot be permitted this time around. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark, for setting the stage for what I would like to say, and thanks to the panelists and USIP for letting us hold a meeting on such an important topic of moving beyond elections in Haiti, because I think that's really the subject we have to do today, is to really move beyond elections. It seems, perhaps as I get older, that I read many articles about beyond elections, but one of the most interesting pieces that was ever written about a decade ago was by journalist Tina Rosenberg in describing the Latin American electoral cycle when she said, we have to move beyond elections to create citizens. And perhaps this first round in Haiti with the national identification cards and the beginning of the creation of citizenship might be a first step. However, I come from a peace-building background, and I would like to say that peace-building is not a holding pattern, and that's what we've had for the last 2 years. There is a window now, described by Mr. Bernard, described by Ambassador Maestro, by Mark, of opportunity that always happens in a transformation moment. And if we don't, as an international community, but also as the citizens of Haiti, do not grab this international moment, we will squander the opportunity again, and as Mark described so aptly, we will move into a situation of having a transitional authority in Haiti for not 5 years, Mark, but 10 to 15 years to come. Now, what does this all mean? It means that we have about 4 to 6 weeks to really take action on what has happened. In the next few weeks, there will be a second round of the parliamentary elections. Hopefully, that will succeed. There'll be the installation of a legitimately elected president. But after that, will the international community just give money and walk away and leave the peacekeepers on the ground again? Or will there be serious efforts to assure that Haiti doesn't fall backwards or even further than it is now? And I would say that we have certain precedents, because failure to do this will mean total collapse of the state. I would agree with John Maester, who said it is not a failed state yet, but close to it. If we fail to take action in the next few weeks, we certainly will have it. And as one Haitian sociologist told me about a few months ago, just wait to see what happens when that window closes. We will see violence and terror as though we had never seen it before, and the kidnapping rate will surpass what it is now. Now, as someone who also studied Iraq, I will say that Haiti is no Iraq, but we need to apply the lessons when we fail to plan after a transitional event to the situation in Haiti. The scale is smaller, the likelihood of success is greater, and certainly anything that is as close to our border as Haiti requires a serious effort of nation building that is not poorly planned, but rather is resourced and has given the time frame we have, well done. We've tried it once. We tried it in 94. We didn't succeed. We know why we didn't succeed. Some of it has to do with the withdrawal of a mission too early. But at that time, I think we were also in a learning mode. When I was at AID in 94, I was told to write a 6-month plan for demobilization and then to get out when I was in the Office of Transition Initiatives. We would never think of a 6-month time frame now, but that was what was being allowed. So we have to take the lessons we've learned and not discard them, but apply them. Kofi Annan, Secretary General of the UN, said when Aristide was removed from office that it would take at least 10 years at a minimum to restore the damage that had been done in the decade. And he said, I'm only being given a 2-year window to do this. And I think we're at that same point again. If we don't use that 2-year, that 6-week window we have now, I suspect that the hope that has been generated by people getting to vote, by perceiving themselves to be part of a nation, will once again dissipate. Now, there are three priorities that are essential, and I will say that we need to restore the legitimacy in the electoral process. And despite the wonderful work that Mr. Bernard has done, I want to tell him that he there's a very interesting definition of courage that I will give to you. Courage is fear that has said its prayers, and I think that's what you've done by going forward and making sure that there is a legitimate process. But if the parliamentary elections in the second round are not perceived as legitimate, we will have a problem, and the installation of an elected president will be in question. Second point, though I would always say security is first, is that security has to be provided adequately, and not only in Port-au-Prince, but around the country. We know there are many ways to do it, but we even know right now that there's a shortfall in the supplemental budget that would create the resources from the United States, 27% contribution to peace building, which will not be met under the current provisions. And third, we need to come up with a strategy of hope. And I don't mean this in any rhetorical fashion. We need to provide the jobs, the regional types of solutions, the tangible things that make people say, I want to live there. We need to create, as our colleagues at the Brookings talk about, a happiness index, an index where people know that the next generation of Haitians will be happy. But I also want to talk about the neighborhood that Haiti lives in, because I do think that the neighborhood it lives in also has a responsibility. Haiti shares an island with the Dominican Republic, and we need to save Hispaniola. The Dominican Republic has its own problems. In addition to the historic pressures at the border of Haitians constantly coming across the border as economic refugees, immediate investments could be made to create jobs at the border, which are really only underway right now at a very incipient stage. Also, to address the deforestation, we know that there is plenty of agricultural agronomist information that an agronomist told me that if there were plantings of chitrofa, which is a seed-bearing plant which produces oil, you could restore the topsoil of Haiti in 3 to 5 years in some of the most arid areas. But, of course, you need security to create these projects. So we need to look into some of these alternate energy projects that could help in the Haitian situation, and these could be done bilaterally with the Dominican Republic. Finally, I think in the sense of what we need to do regionally, there have been regional actors who want to help. And certainly, in addition to the Dominican Republic and the goodwill that it has shown in trying to get things off the ground, I don't know if many of you realize President Fernandez went to the Dominican Republic in December to try and meet with the parties, the opposition parties, the candidates, was pushed off and flew back to the Santo Domingo, but he has once again said that he will meet with Preval and there will be meetings to try and establish a good bilateral relationship. But CARICOM, who was furious about the removal of Aristide, has also come forth over the last 2 years, recognizing that we all share what the United States has called our third border. We forget in an age of post-911 that the Caribbean is our third border, and we need to consider how Haiti fits in the context of a third border strategy for the United States policy. Now, I was very glad to hear Ambassador Maestro talk about a relevant multilateralism. It was the first time I heard the term, and he says he invented it, but that's good. I want relevant multilateralism to move forward, because that is precisely the way at a regional level we are going to get some security for the case of Haiti. Haiti cannot help itself except through the infusion of goodwill, resources, and helping a population that has suffered time and again at the hands of various political rivals. And I want to point out a historical fact. The last peace accord that I can find at all for Haiti, which is unusual in a transition, was the Governor's Island Pact, which, by the way, called for a national dialogue but was never implemented, and that was in 1993. So we need to think back that Haiti is a strange transition politically, because there has never actually been a written pact, save for the resolutions at the United Nations or at the OAS, that lays out the steps. And you can't wink and nod and say you're going to have a dialogue if you really don't want to abide by that. And that's where I think regional actors who see their fate tied to having a failure of a state in its own hemisphere coming forward. Now, what are the U.S. interests in Haiti? I heard a lot of tactical interests that I was told. I mean, we certainly want to keep the lid on a failed state. We want to prevent the collapse of its neighbor, the Dominican Republic, which, by the way, has the second highest growth rate in Latin America. We want to prevent boat people from coming to the United States, though we've pretty much put a lid on that through keeping people at the Turks and Caicos Islands. But we also want to prevent terrorists, drug traffickers, and criminals from using Haiti as a launching pad for illegal attacks. against the United States, not because Haitians will commit them, but because the porosity of borders, because of the openness of the situation will allow it. 15% of all transshipments of drugs comes through Haiti right now, and it's growing. And that is something that certainly is anathema to our own policies of anti-narcotic control. So in addition to dealing with these tactical interests, which are, of course, immediate and relate to our broader security interests, we need to look at our broader strategy within the Caribbean. And that broader strategy has to do with energy security. No island, with the exception of Trinidad and Tobago, has its own source of energy. We need to help Haiti and its neighbors become independent of Petrocaribe. We need to have it become independent and create its own use of sugar. We have to end sugar subsidies so sugar will become a viable crop for ethanol as opposed to selling it at you know, inflated prices that our Congress does. There are ways to make the Caribbean a self-sufficient area, and Haiti can be part of that project. Its Caribbean neighbors want it to be part of that project, but we must do it now. That's what the future holds if we look at it positively. And what are the alternatives if we don't do this? Well, we know what the alternatives are. A transitional UN administration in Haiti for the next decade. I think the UN does not look forward to doing this, but it will because it is the UN. The GAO, by the way, just said that the peace operation in Haiti, I don't know if you've seen the 21st of February report, actually would cost half if the UN managed it, if rather than using U.S. troops. They gave an estimate of $428 million for 14 months of MINUSTAH versus costing it out for a U.S. mission to Haiti, which would be $876 million. So the answer is that if there is a transitional administration, we will pay our 27%, but we will get a real bargain. And CARICOM. CARICOM has also suggested a two-year window to address the most urgent problems in the region. A statement by CARICOM last week said health care, staunching the flood of AIDS. By the way, I think the AIDS rate, by the way, Mark, is about 9%, but, you know, who's going to quibble over 4% when you have the highest seropositive population outside of sub-Saharan Africa living at your third border? We need to deal with education. We need to deal with resource development. We need to deal with infrastructure. And CARICOM has taken an offer to do a brokering role with Haiti that could be backed up with our trade policy. We have the CAFTA DR. Now we should begin to think about linking our economic policies in the region into the broader context of how Haiti fits to prevent state failure. Failure of Haiti is going to happen if we don't take action, if the Haitians don't take action. But I really believe, like my co-panelists, that this may be our last chance when we have this window to act now, because if we don't act now, I think we will be going into a long period of transition that will affect not only Haiti, but the Dominican Republic, the rest of the Caribbean, and certainly our own pocketbooks. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank our panelists for what were certainly extremely insightful and informative presentations. We now have exactly an hour left. I'd like to invite anyone in the audience who'd like to ask a question to come to the microphone on the left-hand side of the room from my perspective. I'd like to ask people to limit their questions to questions and not to take advantage of the opportunity to make a statement. And while people are moving to the microphone, I'd like to exercise my prerogative, the prerogative of the chair, and take a poll of the panel and ask them a simple question, but one I think that is extremely important to Haiti's future, and that is to see what they think about the likelihood of President Aristide returning to Haiti at an early date. So we'll start with Mark.
I can't think of a worse possible event to undermine the transition in Haiti, to undermine the efforts to establish an effective government. My hope would be that all of those who advise President Aristide would advise him that if he cares about the Haitian people and that he simply should stay where he is and to recognize that his return at this time would be totally counterproductive to all of the efforts to build the institutions of democracy and to provide some economic support for the reconstruction of Haiti.
I do share Mark's opinion on that, and I think it would be very bad for Haiti for Aristide to come back, and that is the reason why I was so disappointed that Préval chose the word he chose, because it is precisely Aristide's style. And that very same crowd that went to the street to acclaim Préval is going to be that very same crowd that is going to repeat it for Aristide. And that is the reason why I am so disappointed in the route that Préval chose to take.
Ambassador? Aristide is the past. He is divisive. He is disruptive. I think Mark Schneider stated it very, very well. And the president of the CEP put a very incisive view on it. I would add one more thing. Another Haitian of the past has no business thinking about returning either, and that's Duvalier. So these are people of the past. Haiti has a chance now, and if Haitian democracy is going to be able to take advantage of it, people like those two, if they really care about Haiti, should just stay where they are.
Well, I would just say one quick thing. I think you can't stop anybody from traveling, so I think these are counterfactual assumptions. I do believe he will try and come back and will make it back. The question is, what do we do with someone like Aristide? And Aristide, my opinion has always been for a long time that we should have set up an institute for him. He could have become an educator and a diplomat and a preacher, and had been very effective, because he does resonate with people in the developing world, and he has a charisma. He is a priest. He didn't become head of Lavalas for nothing, and we should build on those talents and give him a job, because that kind of a job would certainly be a constructive way, as he is recognized by many Haitians, and would perhaps could be done offshore, could be done somewhere else. But this has always been a plan that I had. I remember, John, coming to see you and talking about this and people looking at me like I was crazy. But I still feel that Aristide plays a role, not a constructive role when he's without portfolio, but with portfolio. Perhaps now if Oscar Arias becomes the president of Costa Rica and the votes are counted, he can take over the Arias Foundation for Peace and Security and, you know, work there and become the new leader for that type of issue in the region. But I think he will come back, frankly, and I do think we need a plan, because working without a plan is definitely a formula for disaster.
Thank you very much.
Let me just make one other point, that when President Préval was asked that question recently, and it's in Le Monde, he said that I believe it's Article 44 of the Constitution that provides the right to any Haitian citizen to return, not to be exiled. But then he said that Article 45 establishes that no Haitian is above the law. And I would hope that, this is what he said, that President Aristide would recognize the difficulties that former President Fujimori is going through, and that there are court, that he didn't go take the next step, which obviously would be that in Haiti there's an ability for individuals to bring cases against him within the court system.
I'd just like to note that Jacques Bernard really does have his copy of the Haitian Constitution with him, and he just checked it. Any questions?
We got it covered.
I'd like to ask our questioners to identify themselves before they ask their questions, and also to keep it short, because we have a long line and a short period of time. Peter?
Peter Gantz, Refugees International. We conducted an assessment mission last year to Haiti. We conducted interviews in Cité Soleil, and one of the questions we were asked is, what is MINUSTAH going to do for security? When the Marines were here, we felt secure, and we do not feel secure with MINUSTAH. So I say this by way of emphasizing Mark's point. Notwithstanding the amount of money that the United States has spent and plans to spend, our role could be much more productive. And in fact, that is my question to, and I think in particular, Ambassador Maistre, but also to the other panelists. What is or what should be the U.S. plan to ensure that Haiti does not fail, that to use the words of one of the books from USIP here, how do we ensure that viable peace actually takes root in Haiti? When we were there also, we toured the police academy that the United States spent millions building, and it was lying in ruins. So how do we avoid this pattern of failure that we've experienced thus far in Haiti?
I think all the panelists have pointed out that it's going to take a real effort on everybody's part. If you're looking for a silver bullet, I don't think the United States is going to be able to provide it, quite frankly. What happens in Haiti is going to depend upon the goodwill and the common sense of the entire Haitian political class, for starters, and the ability of President-elect Préval to exercise leadership the way he obviously wants to, which in turn is going to depend upon the support, the substantial support, the support for an extended period of time of the international community, key players in which are the United States, the United Nations, the Organization of American States, and countries, big countries in the hemisphere, like Brazil. And by the way, the Mexicans have played a very useful role on the election side. And, of course, France. But it's going to take quite an effort. Let me add one more point. The notion that, gee, if the Marines were there, everything would be just fine, is really a blast from the past. I would venture to say that that is perhaps not the way for the United States to go forward if we really want to see multilateralism contribute the way it should. Because the United States has tremendous interests in the Caribbean, but so do all the Caribbean countries, and so do all the other hemispheric countries. And so does Canada, which has a good chunk of the diaspora. So it really requires, and Joanna's right, a well-thought-out way ahead, which is going to be very, very costly in terms of both money and presence.
My name is Rick Swartz. I'm chairman of the board of the National Coalition for Haitian Rights. I'm here representing our widely respected executive director, Jocelyn McCalla. And I'd first like to inform the audience and the panel that Johnny just about 5 months ago did a report on the future of Haiti, Lurching Toward 2006. It's available on our website at nchr.org. And I think its general themes and direction is consistent with the panel's analysis and projections. I have three quick questions. Co-administration of Haiti going forward. There's been a variety of allusions to the need for to avoid a failed state, for there to be very consistent hands-on help, whether police dealing with corruption. The concept of co-administration as a transitional matter, question one. Second, sustaining over significant periods of time the types of approaches you've outlined will require significant domestic political support for those programs, for that funding, both in the United States, in the Caribbean, and in other relevant countries. In the past, Congressional Black Caucus and others have played a very important political leadership role. What suggestions would you make, particularly in the American political context, to rebuild a constituency for Haiti, which will be required? And the final final question has to do with the role of the Haitian diaspora, both politically and in terms of administration, as just been mentioned, whether in Canada, the United States, France, or elsewhere. Policemen, financiers, health workers, et cetera. We have extraordinarily talented and committed diaspora. How can we tap that talent, both for political purposes and for administration and execution purposes?
Thanks very much. Joanna?
Well, I'm sure other people, and I'm sure Mark has some thoughts on this also. On the diaspora, I will say one thing that I did work on, which is an
old idea was a return of talent bill, which actually Senator Biden put forward but never got into the final authorization, which would allow people who are here, it would affect anybody who was here legally, who was waiting for their citizenship, to get the time in class told so that they could return to their country for up to 18 months without compromising their status in class and actually letting them work in the country where there was an upheaval or a revolution or a post-conflict. Senator Biden has pushed that forward. I've worked with his staff. I think it's something that would benefit all diasporas in this country who want to do something but also don't want to compromise their chance to lose that opportunity to become a U.S. citizen. So that's, the first point. Absolutely needed, especially as we go into a world that continues to have conflicts. On the second point that you raise about building a constituency, I'm sure everybody in this room, and there are many people much more capable than I am, to talk about it. I mean, the good news we know from the 2004 election, for example, in Florida, is that Haitians are registering to vote and they are becoming important political parts of the Democratic and Republican parties in the states that they're in, so that there is a growing awareness that as a constituency, Haitians matter. Not enough to give them the privileges of Cuban Americans yet, but enough to raise their voices in certain districts in the state of Florida. I think there needs to be more grassroots efforts to build that. I think the biggest problem we have is in the Congress. There isn't a constituency in any way from any kind of real serious foreign policy endeavor. It's where they're cherry-picked. So you have a Congressman Wolf who's dedicated to the cause of Darfur, a tremendously critical issue. You have people who have their pet projects, but no overall broad need, which we know that foreign policy does not resonate with voters and therefore doesn't raise PAC money and therefore doesn't get people elected. So I think you're talking about a much bigger problem of getting people embraced on it. But to me, the biggest constituency, which I think would be an important one, would be the contrarian constituencies, the Armed Services Committee, people who know that they don't want to spend the rest of their life running transitional administrations or policing operations in the Caribbean, but rather want a stable and secure environment. So I would look there. I don't want to be the only one. I'm sure Mark has some ideas as well. And anybody else on this panel?
Yeah. A couple things. One is I think co-administration is a bad term. Mm-hmm. I think that I think that in some areas it's effectively necessary. That's what I was suggesting with respect to the police and the partnership by the World Bank on the issue of the ports and on monitoring expenditures. And that kind of partnership, I think, is necessary. I'm hoping that the SOFA provides some of that with respect to the police now. The Security Council resolution gave the MINUSTA the authority to vet police for human rights and criminal backgrounds. They have been implementing it with respect to new police recently. What I think is necessary, though, is in fact an increase in the international police during this time period. They need to vet. The international forces need to vet every single policeman who's currently in the Haitian National Police, starting with the top. Absolute Mario Andrussol is good, but he should offer to go through a vetting process. And during that period is when you need the boost in the number of international police on the ground. But that is absolutely essential to provide confidence to everyone in Haiti and elsewhere. And again, on the justices, judiciary as well, you need to have that kind of vetting for criminal corruption and take place. On the question of domestic political support, you know, one of the things that Senators Nunn and Lugar were able to do some 10 years ago was to say that there is a need for a 10-year program to deal with the problem of nuclear waste, nuclear materials in the Soviet Union. Something like that needs to be built. The bipartisan staff report was from Senator Lugar and Senator Nelson. It seems to me that those two senators might think about crafting, on the Senate side, something like a 10-year commitment to the reconstruction of Haiti. And then on the House side, to have, as you said, the Black Caucus and some of the Florida delegation join in matching that on the House side and make that kind of a commitment and begin to try and build support for it with the administration in the Congress. This is the time to do it.
And that is, as you're going into a new government, not 3 years or 2 years down the road.
Thanks. Ambassador, and then Jean.
Very briefly, with regard to all three points, I concur with Mark with regard to co-administration. The vetting process is really tremendously important with regard to the police, security forces, the justice, et cetera. And we have been providing assistance for that, but not only we, but other donors and international financial institutions should as well. With regard to the diaspora, the diaspora is there. Exactly how to deal with them is going to be an opportunity and a challenge. Our Canadian friends periodically have meetings of the Canadian government with the diaspora, and Brian, I think we have done something similar, and I'm sure we'll continue. With regard to support for Haiti, the Secretary of State made very clear before the Congress the other day that the administration is going to be working with the Congress on support for the Preval government, because it is, as Joanna Mendelssohn says, a window of opportunity that we must take advantage of.
With respect to the diaspora, I think the diaspora is already playing a very important role in Haiti. In fact, I don't know that Haiti would survive without the diaspora. You have to realize that the diaspora is transferring between $800 million to $1 billion a year into Haiti, and that is the money that is allowing Haiti to purchase the food that is necessary to avoid starvation in Haiti. From that point of view, I think the diaspora is already playing a very important role. As far as to their know-how and investment in Haiti, the diaspora is like any other investors. It's a question of risk and reward. If the security situation remains the way it is, one should not expect the diaspora to come in and invest in Haiti. So therefore, I think there is an urgency to solve the security situation in Haiti and for the government to make sure that if the diaspora indeed is coming to invest in Haiti with money and know-how, that the risk factor is somewhat reduced to allow them to make that decision. But I can tell you that the diaspora is looking very closely at what happened to somebody like me. And that is the reason why I think the government of Haiti needs to move very quickly to reassure people, Haitian, that are living overseas, that if they come to Haiti to either invest or help the country and continue to send money into Haiti, that that indeed there is some guarantee as to their safety. But I can tell you that when you look at the imports of Haiti, when we import about almost everything we consume in Haiti, we wouldn't be able to do it without the transfer, the unilateral transfer from the diaspora. Imagine a country like Haiti that is importing about $800 million of goods and services, but only export less than $200 million. And the gap between import and export is covered by money sent out by the diaspora, so that the current account is more or less in equilibrium. So I think the diaspora is already playing a very important role. The diaspora can play even a more important role, but it is really up to the international community to help Haiti resolve the security situation internally to attract foreign investment or diaspora investment into Haiti.
Thanks very much. Next.
Yes, my name is Jean-Michel Voltaire. I'm from Haiti. I'm an attorney with the Justice Department here. my question is for Jacques, Mr. Bernard. And there has been a report in the news media that you have engaged in manipulating and tampering with the final result. And those allegations were leveled against you by two members of the CAP itself. And it's my understanding there has not been an investigation to substantiate those allegations. And you have criticized Preval for taking advantage of the fragile situation to put people in the street and grab power, essentially. And this political compromise was brokered by the international community and also by the interim government. And in my view, by disregarding this blank vote, both the international community and the interim government have abandoned the Constitution for the sake of administrative convenience. Is that in itself, does that harm the democratic process or does it advance it?
Thank you.
First of all, let me make one thing very clear. I expressed my own personal opinion that I thought that there were other ways of handling the situation, namely that you could have recourse to the law. That's one way of doing it. The other way, you could go to a second round. I think one very important aspect that has been neglected in all the presentation here is the role of the CEP, because it just so happened that the people in Haiti, they do not believe in election. And if they do not believe in election, it doesn't matter what security you put in the country, it doesn't matter what economic growth you can foster. I think that you would always have a government that would be considered illegitimate. So I think besides everything else, in addition to everything else, I should say, that was said here, I think there is a need to really consolidate the CEP and to transform it into a valid institution that people believe in. Because if you do not believe in the institution that is organizing election, you would not believe in the government that would be issued from this election. And that is something that has always, always been neglected by the international community. And I can tell you that it is the first time in Haiti, in the history of Haiti, that elements of modernity were introduced into the electoral process. The identity card that was introduced and the registration of it and the management of it was done by the OAS, and they did a wonderful job. I can tell you that of the 3.5 million people that were registered and that have their card, about 600,000 of them never had any identity papers. They were just in Haiti, but nobody could have identified them as Haitian citizens. And they were people in for generations. Because there were people in Haiti, in order to have the card, they had to go with two people who already had the card to identify them, because they had absolutely no birth certificate, absolutely nothing to identify them as citizen of Haiti. So I think the introduction of the identity card, what we call the SIN, and done by the OAS, is one very basic important element of modernity that was introduced in Haiti. And the card is used as a voting card, but it is primarily an identity card. The second element, as I mentioned earlier, was the voting centers. And finally, the third element is the tabulation center, which is very important because you can sit in your living room here in the States and go into the internet and see exactly what's going on about the elections in Haiti. So I think the process is very transparent. Now, as to the charges levied against me, I can assure you that at the tabulation center, we don't count votes. The votes are counted at the polling station, in front of the political party representative and in front of the international and national observers. All we receive at the polling station are the reports that indicate the number of void votes, the number of blank votes, the number of people who voted, the number of ballots that were not used, and, of course, the number of votes for each candidate. So we receive the report. All we do ourselves at the tabulation center is to tabulate them. And we went through the trouble of having two separate lines of checking those numbers so that if the numbers don't match, it won't go into the system. The computer would kick it out so that somebody would investigate to see why is it that the same report that you entered twice and the operators don't know exactly which operator entered what report, so there could not be any collusion among the operators. So I think there were a number of elements put in place to ensure the integrity of this election. But let me say this, that these two members of the board that you mentioned, they were criticizing the results even prior to the election because they did not want election. And I, as I said earlier, I warned the international community and everybody involved that if they could not stop the election, then they were going to attack the results of the election, which they did. And I did not really criticize Préval. All I said is this, and I said that Préval was in Marmalade. Préval is not responsible for the crowd in the street. It was these two gentlemen, or I don't know if I should call them gentlemen. It was these two men who were basically inside the crowd to go into the street, and Préval coming back from Marmalade as a politician, he kind of rode the wave, and he was very clear and very candid about it. He said, well, I'm going to try to do what I can, but I'm not sure that I can really control it at this point. And I think he did what he did to control it. But I guess my point is, if you have election, if you have an electoral body where the people do not believe in the results of the election, then the government itself becomes illegitimate in the mind of the people. So that is, it is quite important for the CEP to be reinforced and for the people of Haiti to start believing that institution.
Thank you. I'd like to...
You want to go? Okay. Let me just make a point here. There has to be a distinction made. Under the Constitution, there's a permanent electoral council that has to be established through the local elections, which have not yet been held and are being postponed sometime into the future. That's a problem. And as we saw, the provisional electoral council that was named has been extremely politicized in terms of both partisan identification and interests. And in that process, you don't have professional administration of the electoral process. And because we're going to have now the selection of a permanent electoral council delayed, one way that I'm hoping that the President Préval, the Parliament, and the international community might move forward would be to suggest a law for a permanent electoral administration that would be there, that would be professional, merit-based, perhaps asking Elections Canada to define sort of job descriptions, information systems, management systems that would be needed, and then to have that essentially be voted on and created through a law without changing the constitutional provision to have a permanent electoral council that would, in a sense, oversee on policy basis this administration. But at least that might provide the kind of longer-term professionalism that's been missing.
Okay, I'd like to ask two of our questioners to speak one after the other, because you've been standing for a very long time. You've been very patient. So we'll take two questions now, and then we'll have an answer. So please.
Non, pardon, c'est Lovensky Pierre-Antoine.
My name is Lovensky Pierre-Antoine.
Organisation Fondation 30 Septembre.
I am the national coordinator for the September 38 Foundation in Haiti.
Je suis haïtien.
And I am Haitian.
M'a regardé ça là matin là, moi pensais que gon seul grand absent dans débat d'intérêt ça, c'est peuple haïtien.
I am looking in this room this morning and I notice there is a great absence here. That is the absence of the Haitian people.
Ou plutôt, il y a un minimum, ne serait-ce qu'un minimum de respect pour le peuple haïtien, hein, pour loi liée, pour constitution. Là.
You guys don't show here not a single minimum respect for the Haitian people or the Haitian constitution.
Pas gain aucun ami étranger ou bien un soeur, un frère étranger qui a dit qui haïtien qui peut entrer en Haïti ou qui haïtien qui pas doué entrer en Haïti.
It is not, there is not a single Haitian friend who can say which Haitian should be allowed to enter Haiti or which Haitian should not allow to enter Haiti.
Quitter loi dans pays d'Haïti avec haïtien régler problème ça.
let the Haitian law and the Haitian people make that decision.
Thème qui rassemble toute gros tête qu'il a yo, c'est l'avenir pays d'Haïti.
The theme that has gathered all these big heads of organizations is the future of Haiti.
Depuis 1915, ou peut-être même avant, le gouvernement pays les États-Unis a posé problème à venir pays d'Haïti.
Since 1915 and even prior to 1915, the United States has been addressing the issue of the future of Haiti.
Sir, with all due respect, could I ask you to ask a question and not to make a statement? Please.
Donc, 90 ans après, qui constate nos faits aujourd'hui de problèmes ça qui posé ici?
90 years later, what have you witnessed of that problem here?
C'est son première question.
Deuxième, that's my first question.
Deuxième question, moi. Est-ce que gon côté dans la loi électorale là qui prévoit présence d'un directeur général?
Is there anywhere within the Haitian electoral laws that require a general director of the CEP?
Et donc, qui ça, M. Jacques Bernard, te vient chercher dans le conseil électoral là, alors que son institution indépendante, gouvernement, pas de gain droit pour nommer yon moun là-dedans?
So exactly what was Mr. Jacques Bernard doing within the CEP when the government was not in a position to nominate someone to join the CEP? Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Next question. Let's take two, and then we'll move on.
He kind of alluded to two of my questions, but again, regarding U.S.
Your name, please.
My name is Jean-Yves Pointdujour, and I'm a transportation engineer. Haitians have been living here for over 30 years, and I'm also host of Compute Like a Haitian Weekly Radio Show here.
Welcome.
And by the way, U.S. aid to Haiti has not been used to help the people of Haiti. And we've seen it in the New York Times article, the way that aid was used to undermine stability, to destabilize the government, and we see the way Roger Noriega, NDI, NDE, and IRI, and all the others use it. And by the way, Roger Noriega is to the Haitian people what Bin Laden is to the American people. And I think he should change his name to Roger Ben Noriega. I think it's time that clearly they revisit the whole issue of aid to Haiti. If you're giving us $50 million and that you know $45 million will have to stay here, you can buy the supplies here and then you can put them on a boat and then you can send them to Haiti. And if we're going to get $5 million in cash, we'll get the $5 million in cash. But you have to revisit the whole notion of aid to Haiti, whether the aid will go exactly directly to the people. Now, regarding Jacques Bernard, my question to you is, I heard yesterday on Radio Solidarity that you yourself have said so your own people working with you, to ransack your own farms, and that was verified, and so that you can leave Haiti to city after you. And by the way, the center of tabulation, you did not let anyone there. Minister had to break the door open to let the other CEP members there. I think, sir, you're not doing a service to the Haitian people. You're doing a disservice to the Haitian people. And I think you ought to recognize that. And once more, the Haitian people have demonstrated that they can live in peace. They want to live in peace. But please, don't try to undermine their country. And then
could I ask you to
do not try to stop, undermine please. The rights and the dignity and respect of the people of Haiti. And like I agree with him, no one can tell Haiti or Haitian people that Aristide should not return or not. That's up to the Haitian people. It's not up to nobody else, George Bush, Condoleezza Rice, or any one of you sitting at that table.
Could I ask
Thank you
to take your seat? Thank you.
If I may answer some of the question, the CEP is an institution. Of course, it is an independent institution in Haiti, meaning that it operates outside of the executive. But the question of a director general at the CEP, in every government institution in Haiti, there is indeed a government, a director general. It is a part of public administration law, and it's and I can tell you that the CEP, by the way, even though it's a provisional CEP, but the CEP was never disbanded between election. There was always a CEP functioning with a director general. The only thing is that every time they're going to have election, they name the board members to conduct election. And I can tell you that there are people at the CEP, for instance, the director of administration has been there for 5 years. So the CEP was never disbanded, even after the creation of the first CEP. The only thing is that before they have election, they would nominate board members to conduct election. But as an institution, the CEP has always been there. And as I mentioned to you, that the director of administration has been there for 5 years and is still there at the CEP. So I think that's an easy question to answer. As to myself having the people to burn my farm to be able to leave Haiti, it's the most ridiculous thing that I could ever heard. I had this farm since 1986. I don't have to do anything like that to leave Haiti. I'm a freeman. I usually come and go from Haiti, so I don't need any excuse to do that. In fact, I can tell you that when that happened, it was the people in the area who called the police, and the police came. And so it's not only absurd, it's ridiculous. And let me tell that gentleman that I am a citizen of Haiti, and I have every right that he has to be a citizen of Haiti. And at least I have given an example. At least I took a leave of absence to go and help my country, and one wonder what he has done to even help his own country. So, and I think this is that kind of attitude that discourage the diaspora to go and invest in Haiti and to send money to Haiti and to dedicate their time to helping the country of Haiti. And I resent that, and frankly, I think I am standing on a higher moral ground than you are.
Next question. Can we have our next question?
Hello, good morning. My name is Shirley Pate, and I'm with the Let Haiti Live Coalition here in Washington, D.C. I would like to give the panel the opportunity to provide some comments from a little bit different perspective than what we've been discussing here specifically this morning. Not too long after the U.S.-inspired coup d'etat, February 2004, I attended a meeting of the Haiti Democracy Project, not too unlike the meeting here today, in which there were representatives from the OAS and the United Nations. There were people from the Haitian diaspora. There were also aid and other NGO organizations. And I observed there something that I'm observing here today. And as I said, I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk about a little bit different perspective. What I observed there is the discussion of the intent to send a lot of money to Haiti, to offer various kinds of democracy-enhancing projects within Haiti. And I think that Haiti suffers terribly from the interference of the international community, specifically in this latest instance from the United States, France, and Canada. They have done nothing but destabilize Haiti with the intent of removing Aristide. What I'd like to hear from the panel is this. Can you offer any suggestions for how you think that the international community should try to rein itself in and allow the administration of President Preval to conduct the business of Haiti with the people of Haiti? Thank you.
Thank you. Mark?
Let me just make one comment about the CEP, and that there was a statement about the CEP members not being able to enter the vote tabulation center until MINUSTAH broke down the doors. I was there, I think, on at least on Tuesday, and of the election day and a Wednesday, and I saw the CEP members in the vote tabulation center all of the time. There was a small room in the back where some of the CEP lawyers had been looking at questionable tally sheets, and that door was removed so that there was not a question about the sort of transparency that everybody could see what they were doing. But the CEP members were throughout the vote tabulation center throughout that time period. With respect to the issue of the departure of President Aristide, the role of the U.S., France, et cetera, I think that there's no question that conditions at that time were such that the forced departure of President Aristide took place amid a real concern about increased violence. I don't think it was an absolute voluntary departure. I think the conditions were there that resulted in a decision that he didn't have any other choice. Nevertheless, the reason why the conditions were there were not merely that people had organized in the streets against him. Part of the reason was there were serious allegations of corruption. There were serious allegations of the involvement of his administration in violence that resulted in the deaths of several people. And it was that combination that created a situation, ultimately, in which there's no question that he was, I believe, he felt that he had no other option. In the current situation, I would hope that the international community would work closely with the Preval government in attempting to meet the challenges facing Haiti, that they would do it in a way that would give an opportunity for new institutions to be built that responded to the needs of the Haitian people.
Mr. Bastor?
Thank you. 2 points. First, to state in response to comments and questions, unequivocally, the view of the United States government that the president of the CEP did an absolutely outstanding job to bring a Haitian solution to a Haitian problem, the Haitian way. Secondly, with regard to Ms. Pate's question about how those of us in the international community think about, I'm paraphrasing here, letting the Preval government govern Haiti the way Haitians want it governed. Again, I'll go to Condoleezza Rice before the Congress, and it stands for itself. Quote, we're going to work with the Preval government. We want this government to succeed. We're going to work to see what other resources we may need to support this government, because it's in our interest that there be a democratic Haiti and a Haiti that is stable and starting finally to move toward prosperity.
Yeah.
Can I just make a comment that I think I certainly agree that it always appears strange that Haitians are not on a panel about Haiti, and I don't think that there was any deliberate intent to do anything like that by USIP. But I do think I can just speak for people here who have worked in Haiti year after year, decade after decade. We don't spend our time thinking about this because we dislike the Haitian people or we don't have an interest in the cause. I mean, we have all worked passionately all over your country to ensure that either aid was delivered or progress was made. And we've also been very pained by the kinds of problems that we have seen recurring again and again. And if we had the answers, we would have them. But I think all of us have said in different contexts that the solutions to Haiti's problems come from the Haitians themselves. And I think that's a basic premise of any development type of assistance. And I'd like to reiterate that if there are things that you have expressed that you sense are not being doing right, we need to learn about those gaps because that's where we as a people, we as a group understand these things. But I think I look around this room and I see people I worked with in Haiti 15 years ago, people that I spent on long hours and long drives from 12 hours from Capitan to Port-au-Prince because there were no roads, thinking that maybe when I came back in a decade there'd be roads. So my sense is that there are a lot of people who are tremendously dedicated to the cause of this country, and it would be shortchanging those people because you don't share similar views to think that there wasn't a passion about this place.
Okay, please, next question.
Yeah, my name is Karen Whitus. Since the end of July, I've been the Deputy Chief Election Observer for the IFAS election mission in Haiti. I returned on Friday. I have a couple of, I think, technical questions and then maybe a broader, more philosophical question. On the question of the ID cards, which I agree was just a Herculean labor and allowed a lot of people for the first time to get an ID card under very difficult conditions. Since registration ended, though, mid-October was the absolute final, a lot of people have turned 18 and in theory should be permitted to vote. And I understand the plan was to continue this in perpetuity to allow people to have ID cards, you know, whether they intended to vote or not. So if there's any plans, if and when, to continue that process. I know there's some human resource problems, but that's an interesting question. The other technical question has to do with the security, Minusta security, UN poll security, Haitian police security during voting. And this is my personal point of view. I'm not speaking for IFAS. There are a lot of UN troops who don't come from particularly democratic countries. The UN is not a community of democracies, a lot of people have pointed out. And there were some strange anomalies, seeing troops from countries that do not allow free elections securing or having the expertise to secure polling places, which I think probably requires a certain expertise to secure voting places rather than places of detention. If anyone has any thoughts about addressing that. And then kind of a broader philosophical question. I mean, I too have been in and out working in Haiti for 25 years and have been disappointed and dismayed by lack of progress on a lot of fronts. And I think, Mark, you talked about, you know, here's all the things we need to do now, and Dr. Foreman was saying we have a very small window in which to act before things even hit further bottom. And I guess my question is, why would this be any different? Why are we now at a particular turning point that all this effort of reforms that we've seen go by so many times before would have a different impact than it's had in the last, say, 30 years of intense international involvement and development in the country? Thanks.
Thank you.
I'll answer the ID card.
Do you want to answer? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's true that there are a lot of people who turn 18 in the meantime. And it's just that the Haitian government must create the possibility for every citizen turning 18 to have their ID card. I must tell you that there is already a little bit of fight going on between the Minister of Interior, the Minister of Justice, and the CEP to keep control of the ID card, and I think the Minister of Justice is ahead of everybody else because they have already created a board of director and they have already even rented a place for that. I think from a practical point of view, it doesn't make a lot of sense to provide a card once it's a citizen turn 18 and not having the ability to produce the card. So I think it's the next step that the government of Haiti will have to work on. But I can tell you that there are already 165 permanent sites where people can go and at least register. We had, when we were registering people, 426 sites, and we shut down quite a bit of them, and now we only have them located at the back level. And it's about 142. We're going to reach 165 sites. Now, whether the CEP is going to retain control of that or whether that is going to be transferred to the Minister of Justice, I don't know. It's an executive decision. But all I can tell you is that, yes, there are elements being put in place right now to ensure that once a citizen of Haiti turns 18, that they will have the ability to have their cards, and obviously the government, it's pretty late on that, and I think that should be one of the first priority of the Préval government, is to set up some of the structure to allow people to have their card. If I may touch briefly on the turning point, I think what makes Haiti different now than in the past is that if you look at the social structure of Haiti, throughout the history of Haiti, we never had as many gangs dominating areas of Haiti as we do today. And the second thing, from an economic point of view, Haiti is a disaster. We do not produce anything. We import most everything we consume in Haiti. And I think the third element is that the environment has, the deterioration of the environment has accelerated quite a bit in the past 4 or 5 years. So I think that there are elements now that makes Haiti a very, very dangerous place. And that must be a turning point. We cannot continue to let Haiti drift along the same path. Otherwise, it would be a failed state, a total failed state, and it would be almost impossible to reverse the trend. And Haiti would, frankly, constitute a danger to its neighbors, primarily the Dominican Republic and some of the other islands. So I think it is indeed a turning point in the history of Haiti, given the new realities of Haiti.
I think that, that Jacques has clearly outlined why it is crucial that it be a turning point. And the question, though, it really is, why are we hopeful that it will be followed by the kind of positive action that we all want to see? And here, it seems to me that there are three elements. The first is that we've, I hope, learned from some of our failures 10 years ago and learned from some of the peacekeeping lessons around the world. We know more now than we did in the past about how to help countries move beyond conflict and establish institutions that sustain themselves. And we're not by no means perfect, but we do know more than we did in the past. We know that you can't simply leave after a few years. We know that you have to get security right. We know that you have to disarm the illegal armed groups. You know that the rule of law is absolutely crucial. So we have learned some things. And the second, to be frank, in Washington, I think that the bipartisan determination to stay with Haiti and to help it avoid the kind of failed state situation is new. And I think that we can build on that. And the third is the Haitian people. I just had a feeling, and maybe it's over-optimism, but it was my sense that on election day, talking to the people in the line, that there was a historical, just a shift in psychology that said, we absolutely demand change, and we're willing to make sacrifices to bring about that change. And it's sort of because the gangs and the violence that the people in Cité Soleil do not want that to continue, and the sense that there needs to be a change, and hopefully that will drive the process in the right direction.
Anybody else on the panel? John, did you want to say something?
2 points. Number one, Mark really summed up the lessons learned point that I wanted to make. The international community understands that we cannot deal with Haiti the way we did in the past, cannot make the same mistakes, cannot say, well, they've had their election, okay, and maybe throw a little bit of money at it. A lot of money over a long period of time, a lot of political commitment, identifiable political commitment, on the part of an expanded group of countries and institutions, and international financial institutions, by the way. Secondly, the turning point with regard to the Haitian people. You know, there is a common debate going on in the hemisphere saying, you know, poor people really aren't interested in democracy. They are really not interested in liberty. Those are rather, sophisticated concepts. What they really want is food, and they want a job. And that's all. That's all they think about. We're hearing this a lot from South America. The Haitian people really served up a lesson to the world enter this hemisphere. And they are to be admired, standing in line for hours and hours, to simply express their political will, that they want change. What a lesson for this hemisphere.
We have about 7 minutes left in our session here this morning, and then the very powerful people that control space at the Institute come in, and we all just... But I would ask the next two questioners if they would very quickly ask their questions, and then we'll have answers to those questions and an opportunity to wrap up.
My name is Eugenia Charles. I'm the executive director of Fondation Mapu and a founding member of the Let Haiti Live Coalitions. My first question is to Mr. Bernard. Can you talk a little bit about the burning ballots that were found at the dumpster and why those ballots were not counted? How did they ended up at the dumpster? Who was in charge of them and who paid the company to take them to the dumpster? The other issue regarding election is why wasn't the result of the election posted at the bed and the BEC's office, like required by the electoral laws, where citizens from those various departments and offices would have determined for themselves who had voted at this time and perhaps avoid all this chaos that we had had in Haiti. And the other question is what currently is being done within the CEP to ensure that this nightmare doesn't occur again with the upcoming elections on March 19th. For Mr. Schreiner, if you can please tell me when your organization began covering Haiti and what sparked your interest in covering Haiti at this point. And I hear a lot of things about Mr. Schreiner. You talk about the port administration in Haiti that's a little bit has a lot of corruptions and not properly being managed. Are you advocating for that particular institution to be privatized? On the issue of Haiti being an economic disaster, I would like to know if I can get an answer as to how and when will you guys start asking the international community to enable the Haitian government to provide subsidies to its farmers so they can produce the things that they need to feed themselves and maintain the economy in Haiti. On the issue of democracy, I'm almost finished. You are discussing Haiti's future. You haven't given Haiti a chance for democracy to prevail. And when will you think about that and give the people a chance to move ahead with their own decision, their own president? Because I don't think you are in the right position to decide for the people who should be president and when they should be elected.
One more, and then we'll close down.
Thank you. My name is Kathleen Sengstock, and I'm with Congresswoman Maxine Waters' office. And then my question is actually very similar and follow-up to Eugenia Charles' first question on the elections and alleged fraud. It was mentioned that the counting was actually done at the voting centers and not by the CEP. It was my understanding also that the votes were counted with representatives of the parties present at each of these voting centers, and that they had to sign off on the count, and then the count was posted at the door. Now, the initial results of the election that were reported indicated that Préval had won between 60% and 90% of the votes at the election centers that were posting the next day. And I think that part of the reason that the Préval supporters were so upset when Préval's percentage dropped down below 50% over the weekend is that they had already seen the initial reports. My question is, and one of the things I found curious is that one of the initial reports I saw was that even in Pechon V, it was posted that he'd gotten between 60 and 90%. So my question is, was there any attempt made by the CEP to verify the results? It seems to me in any contested election, you need to start by checking your numbers. Was there any attempt to go back and check at each of the voting centers and check not only the posted results, but the results that were distributed to each of the party representatives that signed off on them and make sure all of the numbers matched the numbers that were being reported by the CEP that added up to below 50% for Préval? Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we have a couple of minutes left, and we'll try to give Jacques an opportunity to respond, and then we'll close down. I'm sorry we're not going to get to the last two questioners. We just don't have the time. Thank you.
As to the burning ballots, I can tell you exactly where they were stolen. It was in a school in Croix-de-Beaucaire called École Nationale Mercadieu. And those ballots were stolen there. And we were able to identify the polling station. We, from that, we got the name of the people who are at the polling station. And we have already informed the Minister of Justice and everybody involved so that there would be an investigation and these people will be questioned. So we find out exactly why this ballot disappeared from that polling station. But let me say that most people in Haiti discarded this as a setup because of the coincidence of the situation. And it's a situation where it has rained for 3 days and those ballots were completely dry and started to burn. So it looks very suspicious, and we thought it was another attempt to incite the people toward violence. Most politicians and Preval himself at the end discarded this, and frankly, it's not something that they even talk about in Haiti anymore. But let me say that the good news is that we were able to identify the voting center, the polling station, and the people who work there, and the investigation is continuing. That's all I would say about that. Let's see. In terms of the bed and the backs, let me say that what we did, the report, which we call procès-verbal, has 6 copies. One of them is posted at the polling station so that the political party representative and the observer can see exactly what is posted there. One of them would go to the back, and one of them would go to the bed, and 2 of them would be given to the political parties who obtained the most number of votes, and the last one would come to the tabulation center. Let me say that one of the reasons we put up a tabulation center, it is precisely because in the past, when you have election and the political party representative are there at the polling station and observers are there, everything would go well. And then they would take the reports to the backs and the bed, and that's when they start falsifying the reports. So it was an attempt to make this election transparent and to make sure that the results of the vote will reflect the will of the people. So I think it's a tremendous progress on the part of the Electoral Council to make sure that the results of the election were valid. The second thing I would say, I don't know why you say that they were not posted. Indeed, I would agree with you that there were some back who did not post some of the results, but their function really is to compile the results and then to forward them to the bed, and then the bed themselves would be the one to post them. But what we did this time, we add one additional security measure to make sure that we also count them in Port-au-Prince, and to make sure that if there is any difference between the results at the bed level and the result at the CEP central level, that we can reconcile it. And I can tell you that we haven't had any challenge in terms of the political parties as to the actual results 3, 4, even 5 days after the elections. So to that extent, rather than seeing this as a weakness, I think it's a strength to the system to make sure that the vote really reflects the will of the people. There is no question about it that there were some mistakes made. It is the first time that we have organized this kind of election in Haiti, and we have learned from these mistakes, and measures are being taken to correct this mistake. One of the major mistakes, for instance, is that the voting centers, the workers there would go there pretty late. You know, they're supposed to be there at 5 o'clock, and they would arrive after 6 o'clock, when in fact we already have thousands of people waiting in line. So that's one thing that we notice that we need to correct. The second thing is that when we printed the list electoral partielle, which is a list that show the voter's ID and also pictures, by the way, and that's one thing that people don't realize. It's not just the card. At each polling station, there is a sheet that has the picture of the voter. So that's an additional measure to verify that it is indeed the person who is voting. And it was printed maybe a month prior to election, and in the meantime, there has been some changes. So that has also created some problem. So we have learned through the experience, but all in all, these elections were very good, and frankly, I think it would be a tragedy if we were to abandon, you know, all those elements of modernity that we have introduced into the system. When you do election, this kind of election the first time, there will be problems and weaknesses, and I can assure you that there are studies being conducted right now and that there are measures being taken to correct all the mistakes that we have registered in the first round of election. It's, you know, the thing about Haiti, I think, and I mentioned it before, is that it is the first time that you can sit anywhere around the world and go to the internet and analyze the results of the election. The physical location of the tabulation center is around the area where Préval has the most votes. We are located around Cité Soleil, around Delma, around Tabar, and Préval has a lot of popularity in those areas. So when we started to publish the results, Préval was at 65%. And as we enter data coming from around the country, it is to be expected that the percentage would go down. But the reality of it is that Préval had more votes in 9 departments. There is only one department where Préval was not the winner. And frankly, he is a big winner. I mean, 49%, and the next guy after him at 11%, he is a big winner. So I would stop right there because it's a question of time. The time has expired, and I'm sorry that I could go into more detail. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry to draw this to a close. It's been, I think, a wonderful start to this initiative that we look forward to continuing with the beginning of our working group on Haiti. I'd like to thank the panel for their presentations. I'd like to thank the audience for their for kicking off a very lively discussion. Those of you that are here this morning will receive invitations automatically to the next meeting, which will be in late March when we'll look at the issue of security in Haiti. So thank you very much, and safe trip home.